This recording is a production of Anabaptist Financial. More recordings are available on our website at www.afweb.org under the Resources menu or by calling 800-653-9817. This presentation was recorded at a business seminar held on January 20, 2026 in Seneca Falls, New York.
I'm guessing in a group this size, there's some of you here that are struggling in business. So I'm a little apprehensive about this topic. It was given to me when the barns are full. There's an assumption being made that we're living in an extremely prosperous time. And I don't want anyone here who's struggling to feel like they're missing out, but the reality is we are living in a very prosperous time. 2010, the first book that I wrote called Kingdom Focused Finances came out just 15 years ago. And right after that book came out, of course, I was living out on the West Coast, I started getting phone calls. And almost all of the phone calls were people who were struggling with their finances. It might be sometimes it was a wife who had a husband who was struggling. I had a lot of phone calls like that. A lot of people struggling with difficulty with their finances. You know, today, I think I can safely say in the last year, I might have had one or two that are struggling in finances. But typically, I don't get that anymore. Here's what I get. I get bishops or ministers calling and saying, our people have way too much money. I'm seeing all kinds of signs that our young people, they're making too much money. What do we do about the situation? Totally different. I think we need to acknowledge, at least in a general sense, that our barns are full. You know, it's not just difficult for us as believers. Politicians are having a hard time too. If you watch the news, wages are going up. The way of living is going up, and yet expectations are rising even higher than that. And so there's a frustration out there of why can't we have even more than we have. I think it's important that we begin here, though, by acknowledging it's not the same for everyone. I'm starting to hear more and more about a K economy. If you'll think about that just a little bit, look at this chart. I saw a article here recently in The Economist on this topic, and there's two classes of people, and think about these two on this graph here. One is going up. There are people who are business owners, homeowners, stock market investors, and they're seeing their wealth increase. They're feeling really good, and this article called them the Costco or Sam's Club people. They're the ones who their wealth is just increasing. There's another group of people, though, the day laborers, the renters, the uneducated, and their wealth is actually going down simply because of the cost of living is going up. Now, my burden here today is this. Among the Anabaptist people, we tend to be in the top category. And we tend to have little empathy for those in the bottom category. In fact, we don't understand them. If they would just get out of bed and get to work and get some things done around here, they could actually be in the top category. But we actually, as Anabaptists, have some advantages that many people do not have. And much of it has to do with things we did nothing about. It was in the way we were raised. It's been being taught to get out of bed in the morning. It's good role models around us. It's networks. When we have a job loss or need more work or whatever, we have people around us to help us with that. And we don't even think about the advantages we have, and we tend to have trouble empathizing with those who are struggling. So I want to look at five different areas. Understanding the time, I want to look, get a grasp from God's perspective of what kind of a time are we living in. Second, God's consistent message. Very clear warning all through the scriptures about living in affluence and the dangers of it. Three, affluence breeds amnesia. There are some side effects of prosperity. It causes us to forget many things. There's some realities that we tend to forget when we're living in the middle of plenty. Jubilee, understanding God's heart. Why did God set up this system of Jubilee? We have no record it was actually used, but I think we can get something of the heart of God in Jubilee. And then finally, I want to think just briefly about moving from just simply steward to joint ownership, from giving out of duty to actually embracing God's vision of what He's doing in our world and working with Him. You could call it from employee to partner. Let's start with thinking a little about understanding the time that we're living in. You know, this change is actually, I just mentioned, this came fairly rapidly. We don't even notice it. We rarely notice when things get better. What are we to learn from this? One is the past doesn't always predict the future. My father was one who always expected a recession. It was always just around the corner. In fact, we used to joke in our family, he'd cut out little news clippings. Anything that said that we were about to enter a recession, he would clip it out. It agreed with his confirmation bias. He was sure it was true. He would hang on little clippings that turned yellow around the edges. He was positive the worst thing that could happen and what was going to happen was a big recession. He saw it when he was young. He was convinced that was the worst thing that could happen. The reality is it didn't happen. We were very ill-prepared, actually, for what did happen. The slow, silent economic shift. You know, the change has not been ubiquitous. As I mentioned, there are some still that struggle. But in general, if we look back 50, 30, even 10 years, there have been some major changes. Money is simply more plenteous. I see today many more conveniences, many more time-saving things being purchased. I hear about honeymoons in different countries, something that at my age, I had no idea. I never even thought about going to another country. In fact, our honeymoon, we had to cut a day short because we ran out of money, and we didn't go very far away from home. Most financial struggles today are actually self-inflicted. It's more a management issue than it is a money issue. One of my concerns is debt load based on present income. You know, we have a generation that has never seen a major economic downturn. We've never seen that. And as income rises, so does our ability to borrow. We can actually simply have more collateral. And so as that happens, we forget that it may not always be this way. It could go the other direction. Things could actually change. Understanding we live in an American bubble. From a global perspective, what we are experiencing is not normal in our world. Now, I would say this, that most countries are seeing improvement, but it's not all even everywhere. And most people on the globe today would not be able to understand what we're talking about here right now. There's some essential teaching, and I'm going to talk about teaching here several times, and the reason is this. Because as business owners, you simply have influence in your communities. Because of how we regard wealth, we tend to regard those who know how to make wealth very highly. So what you say and what you do and the choices you make are observed by others. A couple years ago, I was in a refugee camp in Iraq, and I spent a good part of the day in a tent there listening to refugees. They were very frustrated. They were angry. It took a couple hours, actually, to get past just the anger. They could actually see where they live from the camp. And they were wanting me to give them something. They knew that I was connected to an aid organization. They were trying to find a way to get something from me. And I was there to try to find a way to help them provide for themselves in a more sustainable way. And so in the middle of this, I noticed some of them were smoking, and so I asked them about their cigarettes, and I did a little math with them and tried to show them how if they would cut out the smoking, they actually could actually save some money and maybe start a little business. And I asked them how many men were there in the camp, what percentage of those smoked cigarettes, and how many packs a day or a week they were smoking, and it came out to about $73,000 per year that camp could have saved if everyone would just stop smoking. But you know, even as I went through this process, this thought went through my mind repeatedly. Are we in America as serious about all this wasted money as what I'm encouraging these people to be? In other words, in your community right now, if your congregation's income would drop by 20%, would anyone go hungry? And the next question would be, is what's happening to that 20% then? What are we actually doing with all this extra that we have? Historical reality. Life hasn't always been like this. Are we teaching stories from the past? I grew up on that, but I'm not sure today's young people are, of what happens in an economic downturn. Could all the debts be paid? Would your community be able to maintain its Christian witness in an economic downturn? Would the loans be paid back? Global reality. I mentioned most of the world isn't like this. Are we sharing that? Or are young people aware that we're living in a weird bubble, actually? It's a small bubble compared to the rest of the world. Are we keeping the needs of others in front of our people? Future reality. It may not always be this way. Are we talking about that? And are you preparing for the threat of continued prosperity? Do you see that as a threat? I sat with a group of men a while back, and I asked them, I said, I'd like for you to take out a piece of paper, these were businessmen, and write down what's the worst thing you can think of happening right now in our economy. And after a little while, I asked them, how many of you wrote down things might get better? I personally believe that might be the worst thing that could happen to our churches. It is just continued prosperity, just a little more, just a little more. Are you preparing for that? Are you thinking about steps, actual steps you're taking in your life to prepare for continued prosperity, continued increase? God's consistent message. If we're not preparing, it's not because God has been silent on this topic. And I want to go through just a little bit what God has said about the dangers of wealth. You know, one of the most dramatic changes, I think, in our Bible is the children of Israel. The change that happened to them. I want you to think about this for a little bit. Moses gave some strong warning to Israel, and the first thing he said was beware. In other words, there's an incredible change coming. They were getting ready to go into this promised land. He describes this place of plenty and how wonderful it's going to be, and he gives them this warning of being careful. But he begins by reminding them of how things have been. Notice this. Remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble thee and to prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandment or no. And he humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger, and fed thee with manna, which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. Thy raiment waxed not old upon thee, neither did thy foot swell, neither these 40 years, and it goes on from there. God had fed them day after day after day. Every day they got up, and there was that manna out there. They knew where it was coming from. They knew it was actually daily bread they were getting. Food was very daily. But he's saying something's going to change now. There's a change coming. Prosperity is coming. The Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land. Notice, a land of brooks, of water, of fountains, and depths that spring out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of oil, olive, and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness, thou shalt not lack anything in it, a land whose stones are iron, out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass. Notice, from manna every day, just manna day after day, suddenly he says you're going to experience things you've never experienced before. It's going to be totally different. There's going to be no lack. It's going to be a wonderful time. From living in tents to actually having substantial houses, things are going to vastly improve. But with all this affluence, he gave a corresponding warning. Beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God, lest when thou hast eaten and art full, and hast built goodly houses and dwelt therein, when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied, all that thou hast is multiplied, then thine heart be lifted up. Now forget the Lord thy God, and thou say in thine heart, my power and the might of mine hand hath gotten me this wealth. Notice God's warning. There's prosperity coming. Be careful. You know, we tend to believe a false narrative in the middle of prosperity, and we say it in all kinds of ways, but basically, I've worked hard and I've earned this. I kind of deserve it, actually. And if it's mine, then I have a right actually to decide how it's going to be used. God's message was clear. Prosperity's coming, and with affluence comes extreme danger. Another place that God speaks of this is Ezekiel. There's a summary of the sin of Sodom. And we're all very familiar with Sodom, extreme immorality. It's so infamous today that we still use the term sodomy to speak of sexual perversion. And yet, notice how God describes the sin of Sodom. Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her, in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw good. Plenty causes us to turn inward, to think about ourselves. And you can see this in developing countries today. I would say that in general, when you go into poorer communities, they tend to take care of each other better than those in affluent areas. And what God intended as a blessing to them actually became a curse. Remember when they left Egypt, they left with all the material wealth. God had intended that be used to build the tabernacle. But what did they do with it? They used that same material to build a golden calf. Abraham's sober explanation, a coming reversal. One of the most sobering messages in the Bible to me, in the New Testament at least, is in Luke 16, where Jesus tells the account of Lazarus there. Remember the account? We have a rich man who lived sumptuously every day. He had a wonderful life. Things were just going good for him. And you have this Lazarus who's living in extreme poverty. And yet there's this reversal comes, and they both died, and Abraham explains why this reversal happened. Notice these words. But Abraham said, "Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things, and likewise Lazarus evil things. But now he is comforted, and thou art tormented." Great reversal coming. It's interesting to note that there's nothing else said. No other reasons here given. That's just where Jesus left it. I suspect the poor went home pretty excited, and the rich went home maybe not so much. I remember being in Bangladesh a few years ago, and there was a man there who had been a Muslim, been converted. And he used some of the hard sayings of Jesus as his devotional, encouraging the people. And I thought, well, isn't this interesting? We call these the hard sayings of Jesus in America. He's using it as a devotional, saying, folks, I know you're poor now, you're struggling, but God has great things coming for you. There's something about prosperity that isn't helpful to our spiritual lives. Wealth is simply dangerous. Jesus gave many warnings regarding wealth. One of them we mentioned earlier, then said Jesus unto his disciples, "Verily I say unto you, that a rich man shall hardly enter into the kingdom of God. Again, I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God." Now, I don't know how you could express the dangers of wealth any more succinctly than that statement. And we come up with all kinds of explanations and commentaries of long passages, but I want you to simply notice what the response of the disciples who heard this was. It says they were astonished beyond measure and said, "Who can be saved then?" They knew exactly what he was saying. I'm just curious, are you that concerned when you read it? Or have we become numb to this message? God's message is consistent. Paul's charge to church leaders. The Apostle Paul gave some pretty grave warnings regarding church leadership, warnings to church leadership about wealth. Paul's first letter, 6th chapter to Timothy. "But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness." He's saying, Timothy, wealth is dangerous. Don't pursue it. Don't go after accumulated wealth. Do you really believe that? Is that part of your DNA as a believer? Have you embraced that reality? Are those around you, would they say you believe that? That you actually believe in the danger of wealth? Would your children say you believe that? Later on in the same letter, "Charge them that are rich in this world, that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. That they do good," speaking of the wealthy, "that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." I used to read this and think this was saying that Paul was writing to rich people. He actually wasn't. He was actually writing to Timothy saying, "You warn the rich people." And I wonder a couple things. If you're leaders here today, are you fulfilling this? Are you as a church leader fulfilling this? And secondly, if you are a business owner, how would you like it if your bishop or your minister came and said, "Are you sure about this? Are you sure you're on the right track?" Do we understand the danger of affluence? God's message is very consistent on this topic. Affluence breeds amnesia. Plenty tends to cause us to forget some things. Some of you may have seen the book called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, written by Carl Truman. Carl Truman is a Reformed theologian. It's a thick book. But he tracks the path in this book of what happens, how did we arrive where we are? And he starts out by saying something like this: how did we arrive in a place where a man can say, "I'm actually a woman trapped in a man's body, and we listen to him. Like how did we get here to this place? And the book tracks history and how we arrived at a place of feeling like our opinion, what we think is so important. But he says this, and it smote me. He says, you know, we tend to think it's other people out there. They're the ones that have all these weird beliefs. But actually, it's the water all of us are swimming in. We've actually come to believe that my own opinion is pretty valuable. It impacts our church life. But he uses this illustration. He says, if someone would have asked my grandfather, who worked in a sheet metal factory for 30 years, do you enjoy your job? He would have said yes. And the reason he would have said yes was it provided an income so he could provide for his family. Today, when I ask you, do you enjoy your job, what does that mean? It means, am I being fulfilled by this? Am I enjoying what I'm doing? The total difference in meaning, simply because we have come to believe that what I want, what I feel, is of extreme importance. Self has come to mean a lot to us. There's a lot of quotes I could bring out of that book, but one of those is simply something like this, that what I think is actually the final arbiter of everything. And you can give me opinions if you want to, but I'll be the final decision maker in this. That's what we have come to believe. There's many things we forget. One is our history. Have you ever tried remembering what it's like to be hungry when you're full? It's just pretty difficult, isn't it? And it's difficult for us today to even relate to poverty because it's been so far from us. We tend to forget what poverty was actually like. We forget our need for neighbors. You know, in the past, I love reading, and many of you have, old stories about how individuals here in America, even in the middle of difficult times, they helped each other as neighbors. Denominational lines went down in emergency. You just got in and helped out. If the harvest needed to be got in, you all worked together at it. Today, neighbors are becoming kind of a burden to us. Like, they're the people that encroach on us. We don't actually need them anymore. And affluence tends to reduce our need for neighbors. We tend to forget the pleasure of small things. My father, I grew up hearing over and over, probably every Christmas, that he grew up in Indiana, and he usually would get an orange and two walnuts. And I remember as a boy growing up in California thinking, what kind of a Christmas would that be? I mean, oranges, we mowed over them. There was plenty of them. I couldn't even relate to his story, but it was excitement to him that an orange and two English walnuts was a big thing to him. It doesn't mean much because with wealth comes increased expectations. We just simply expect more and we lose the pleasure of small things. We tend to forget we're living in a thorn bush. Jesus said this, and these are they which are sown among thorns, such as hear the word, and the cares of this world, and the deceitfulness of riches, and the lusts of other things entering in choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. Thorns don't grow very fast, but they do grow. And they tend to choke out spiritual life. Are we, as believers, in these last days talking about this, about the impact affluence is having on our lives? We tend to forget that endless options brings increased regret. You know, we like lots of options. And in America, we have lots of them. You go into a store, I'm amazed. In fact, I left the hotel early this morning, had about an hour's drive, and I left too early. I wasn't sure how the roads would be. And so I stopped at a large supermarket. It was 6:30 in the morning and just walked. And I was just thinking about this, just the incredible diversity in this store. Now, I get into other countries. This doesn't exist in other countries. It's like a huge diversity of all kinds of things. You pick any one topic, there's 40 different brands of it. There's a book out there written by Barry Schwartz called The Paradox of Choice. He's not a believer, but he writes this, and maybe this will help understand what I mean by an increased regret. He writes about buying blue jeans. He talks about how in the past, when he bought blue jeans, he would go in and buy a new pair of blue jeans, and he knew they would be stiff, they would be uncomfortable, just didn't fit real well, but as he wore them and washed them and wore them and washed them, they gradually got more comfortable. And about the time they really got comfortable, it was time to go get another pair again. You start the process over again. But he said he recently went into a store and he said he wanted to get some blue jeans, and they asked him what kind of fit he wanted and then what kind of material he wanted. And then he wants stone washer. There's all kinds of, you know, 15 different kinds you could get, all kinds of options you could get. He finally got down to a pair of jeans that were just for him. And he said he walked out of that store. It was the most comfortable blue jeans he'd ever had before, and yet they weren't quite perfect. He noticed that they rubbed over there a little bit. This wasn't quite right. And it bugged him because he knew that there was a pair out there somewhere that would have been perfect. But he missed it. And it was his fault. He should have got the right one. He said that he left with a more comfortable pair of jeans, but with less satisfaction than the old ones. Because his expectations were higher now. There had to be a perfect pair of blue jeans. And the problem is what we're talking about here is not just blue jeans. It's shampoo. It is mouthwash, you name it. All these things, we have all these options, and because there's so many options, we tend to live with regret because it's not quite perfect. We tend to forget that our decisions impact others. You know, normal in our church community is always moving. It's always moving. And we tend to forget that every decision we make actually influences normal in our community. And you can think about your house. Upgrades on your house. You can think about the vehicle you buy, the vacation you take. Everything you do actually is moving normal. We tend to forget about that. Our decisions actually impact others. We tend to forget about the poor and marginalized. You know that the rich man, as he went out the gate, he saw Lazarus there every time. And there's many countries that's still that way. You walk out the door, you're going to see extreme poverty. But you know, you can live in America and never actually see real poverty. And I think our plain communities actually are especially vulnerable. We tend to isolate ourselves. We tend to be in nice communities, and we surround ourselves with other plain people. I'm not saying anything wrong with that. But I'm just saying it is easy then to not understand the plight of the poor when you live in that kind of an environment. It'd be very rare for any of us to interact here in America with extreme poverty. I appreciate what was said earlier. Maybe Daryl mentioned about loneliness. That is a poverty in America that's very real. Where I live right now, I could work full-time, I think, on about two blocks of my town just in loneliness, just people who are discouraged and lonely. And we also forget God, the ultimate provider and sustainer. This is probably the most dangerous of all. I think it was Randy Alcorn that said something like this: the problem isn't that God doesn't love the rich, it's that the rich don't love God. In fact, we tend to forget about Him. I want you to consider a statement that John Wesley made one time. He wrote, "I fear wherever riches have increased, the essence of religion has decreased in the same proportion. Therefore, I do not see how it is possible in the nature of things for any revival of religion to continue long. For religion must necessarily produce both industry and frugality, and these cannot but produce riches. But as riches increase, so will pride, anger, and the love of the world in all of its branches." Notice what he's saying. Godliness will produce both industry and frugality, and with that comes wealth, and with wealth comes a decrease then of our attention toward God. And there's a cycle. I want you to think about right now where you are at in that cycle. Where are you? Are you your people? Your church community? Are you aware of the danger that John Wesley was speaking of? Jubilee, I want to look just a little at understanding God's heart. And I don't profess to understand God's heart here, but just think a little about what God might have been trying to express in Jubilee. You know, it's easy for us as Anabaptists to not think about, just let's think about property, buying property. Most of us have somebody to help us, somebody who will sell us something. There's a network out there to help us actually buy that first piece of property. But you know, there's many right here in America, prosperous America, that's clear out of reach. They know right now they're never going to own a piece of property. That number is actually increasing. But think about Jubilee, where actually God wanted occasionally this whole playing field to be leveled out, to make it even for everyone. Very interesting concept. Let's think about a few lessons. First of all, we have been created with different gifts. God simply was saying by Jubilee, he was acknowledging there are different gifts. And this has been alluded to today, that there are some people that what they touch just tends to turn into gold, and others they can be raining $100 bills outside and somehow their bucket's upside down. And that's just kind of how our world is. It's just different. But God acknowledges that in Jubilee. God also wants all of his children to flourish. You're going to see that. God does not take pleasure in poverty and hunger, despite what some might tell us. That's not true. God is not after that. And you see that in Jubilee. He wants everyone actually to have opportunity. Going to level this thing out once again and give everybody opportunity. God hates inequality. He cares about the underdog. You know, you'll see this if you travel around our world very much. We tend to gravitate towards systems where the rich oppress the poor. And you'll see this all around the globe today. But God hates this. He actually cares about those who are being neglected. Now, I want you to think about your business right now. Is part of your business strategy have Jubilee in it, a way of helping those who are struggling? It might be employees. It might be young families. I don't know what it is. But is that incorporated into your business planning? God loves solutions which level out fiscal disparity. You see this in Jubilee. God actually wants that. He wants a system that levels things out again. This desire to share, to level things out, you see it lived out in the early church. When the Spirit, Holy Spirit arrives, distribution happens. You'll see that in Acts. One of the first things that happened when the Holy Spirit comes is they begin to distribute and level things out. They lost their desire for accumulated wealth. The New Testament church, I would say, is to be a public exhibit of continuous Jubilee. We are to be a living example of God's heart in this area. It's said sometimes that we are to live in a way to demonstrate to the world what the whole world could look like if Jesus was actually the king. Now, I want to think just a little bit about from stewardship to joint ownership, and this is not intended at all. I don't know where you'll find yourself in this. It's not intended to condemn, but I want you to think a little about what God has in mind in the middle of prosperity. God talks about tithing. And that's repeatedly, you'll see that in the New Testament. That just means 10%. It means giving 10% of your increase. It's a gift back to God. It's a reminder to us that everything comes from God. There's other ways to give. There was in the Old Testament. But this, you would say, was mandatory. God just said, this is the bottom line. And I think of tithing many times as giving out of duty. It's something that we do because we're supposed to. Even though in the New Testament it's not commanded, it is an excellent place to start. But I want to also say this, I don't believe God intends during times of affluence for us to stay here. You know, a man who is making $1 million a year doesn't need $900,000 to live on. So there's something else God has in mind. And I would call that progressive giving. Progressive giving is simply increasing that percentage during times of affluence, of recognizing that, you know what, I don't need this much. I want to simply share with others. There's another one then that I like even better, and Jesus refers to this. I call it kingdom investing. Jesus taught us to actually lay up treasures in heaven, like invest now in your future. Invest when you get to heaven, there's wealth there. And he says this, Matthew 6:19, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. In other words, invest in the kingdom. If you're willing to invest in the kingdom today, I'm going to bless you down the road. But there's something else that I think God actually is his heart. And I call this partnering with God. It's being an heir and a joint heir with him. It's beyond giving a larger percentage. It's beyond giving so that someday you get something back. It's actually joining with God in what he's doing in our world. It's actually investing with him and being part of it, to where your greatest joy is actually seeing his will come to pass in people's lives. Like nothing else brings you greater pleasure than to see reconciliation happening in our world, than to see the gospel going out, see the poor being helped. Now, I'll say this. I think it takes time to go across this progression. So I'm not putting any condemnation on anyone, but I want you to think about that in your own life, where you are at on this. Are you at a tithing place where you're giving a minimum of what you think God requires? Or are you increasing that to help a little more in acknowledgement we are living in affluence? Or are you actually investing in the kingdom? Or have you moved on to where it's actually God's? And what I want is for his kingdom to advance. John Steinbeck was an American author. He wrote Grapes of Wrath. Wasn't a real godly man. But he wrote this quote. I want you to notice what he says. A strange species we are. We can stand anything God and nature can throw at us, save only plenty. If I wanted to destroy a nation, I would give it too much, and I would have it on its knees, miserable, greedy, and sick. I want you to think about that in our own lives, just the power of affluence to actually change us. You know, it intrigues me that even ungodly people can see the danger in too much prosperity. Even though we know everything I've said, we all know this, don't we? Nothing new here. We've read our Bibles all along. And yet there's something in us many times that still longs for just a little more. I saw this picture a while back. Reminds me of how we are. You know, this mouse, really, he really wants that cheese. He doesn't want the pain. And we're like that with wealth, too. We want the wealth, but we don't want the side effects that come that God has warned us. And so we become creative in our theology. We develop all kinds of things to protect us against what Jesus actually said. We know what the Bible says. We know wealth is dangerous. And yet, we try to find ways in this situation to justify what we're doing. Joseph's son was a Romanian pastor during the time of Ceausescu in Romania, exiled in 1981. He came to America, and after his release, he observed Romanians and how affluence impacted them. And he said this, 95% of Christians pass the test of adversity, while 90% of Christians fail the test of prosperity. I had an experience in 2012 of traveling to Eastern Europe. And the reason I did was there were a lot of people who went through persecution over there in Eastern Europe. And there was a desire to document some of their stories. Just go and I interviewed lots of individuals who'd went through persecution and just recorded all their responses. And I've used some of those in stories, some of them I haven't. But one thing I noticed that was universal, these men I would talk to would describe the persecution they went through. There's some horrendous stories over there. I remember they took me down, one group took me down to where there were baptisms at night. There was a pond there, and they said they would wait till 3 in the morning. They'd take batteries down there and lights, and sometimes there'd be 600 people around this pond for baptisms. They'd go down quietly in little groups, and they said on Sunday the churches were always packed, always full. But they said now it's different. Now we're losing our interest. There's Wednesday night church services, hard to get a crowd anymore. Things have changed. They're not even wealthy. There's something about just having plenty that changes our vision. I remember one account where the believers there had heard that there were other believers in Russia that didn't have any Bibles. They even spoke a different language, but they were very, very concerned about that. And so they took a house there, put mattresses all around the inside so no one could hear from the outside. The police station was fairly close. And they had some kind of ink, the only kind of ink they had that could actually produce Bibles, put off a toxic fume. So they knew that whoever worked inside this house was probably going to do brain damage. And they asked the church then who would be willing, and a group of young girls volunteered. And they worked in this thing, and many of them suffered from it, mentally from it. But imagine the kind of dedication they had in the middle of persecution. Now in the prosperity, they can hardly fill a church. They struggle getting crowds together. All this to say that we underestimate the power of plenty in our spiritual lives. About 10, 12 years ago, I was going to Bangladesh, and on the way, we landed in Qatar, Doha Airport. I don't think I'd ever been to that airport before. And as I walked in up to the counter to get my ticket, they were speaking English behind the counter, and one of the employees there for the airline said, it looks like coach is clear full. And so, trying to make a feeble attempt at humor, I just said, well, you can put me in first class if you want to. And one of the ladies looked up at me and said, okay. And I thought, well, she was just making a joke. And as I walked away from the counter, I looked down at my ticket, and it said first class. And so I got on this plane. It was a brand new 787, and it had a little office I sat in with lay flat seats, and I just messed around with all the buttons, and everything was going up and down and lights, and it was just an amazing place to sit. We got up in the air, and a stewardess came down and kneeled down beside me and gave me these long lists, and basically what she was asking was, did I want lamb or did I want beef? And when I got done with the meal, they came back with blankets, and they tucked me in to sleep, and I remember laying there thinking, you know, I could actually get used to this pretty easy. And I forgot all about the folks back there who were still jostling around with the armrest and trying to decide who actually owned the thing. And I forgot about those people. I just enjoyed life up there. On the way back, I come back through the same airport, different airline. I got on the airplane. It was clear full. I think it was a 777. I was sitting in the aisle, still picture it very clearly, and I just sit down and kind of got my seatbelt fastened, and all of a sudden my seat, wham, wham. They just jerked, and my head was banging against the seat, and I looked back. Here's a little guy about 4 or 5 years old, had his feet up on my seat, and he was enjoying himself. And I looked at his mother, and I knew that I know their culture well enough to know that she was not going to tell him no. And so I thought, this is going to be, I had 15 hours. It was from Doha to L.A., one of the longest flights. And I thought, this is going to be miserable. So as a flight attendant went by, we're still sitting on the runway. My old seat was still just a banging and jerking. And I asked her, I said, is there any other seats on the airplane where I could sit? And she saw my plight, and she went around and looked everywhere, and she came back and said, I'm sorry, there's nothing else available. And this seat just jerked and just was chaos. And as we took off up over the ocean, I began to feel sorry for myself banging around. I thought, this isn't fair. You know, I paid for a seat. I did not pay for this. This isn't right. They shouldn't put people in. All these thoughts going through my mind, and suddenly I stopped and thought, wait a minute. When I flew out of this the last time, I was sitting in first class. I was laying there with a meal I hadn't paid for, a bed I hadn't paid for, all kinds of service I hadn't paid for, and not once, not one time did I ever think about standing up and saying, this isn't fair. It's not fair. I didn't pay for all this. I shouldn't have got all this. But now I'm wrestling with all these feelings about how it's not fair. This isn't right. You know, affluence is that way. It's pretty hard to remember the poor when you're living in plenty. And when things go south, we can feel pretty sorry for ourselves. But when affluence creeps in, we get used to it so easily. We never think about the fact it's not fair. We don't think about the fact that the country we're living in has so much and others don't. We don't think about all that. We tend to forget the plight of the poor. As we leave here today, I want to encourage you as you go back to your homes, to your community, and to your business, to remember that you are simply a steward. That God has blessed you. That God has given you resources. That God has given you maybe money, maybe time. I don't know what it is. But God has given you something with purpose. There's actually real needs out there. There are people who have struggles. It may be time you need to donate. It may be money that needs to donate. I don't know what it is. But remember that you are simply a steward, and join with God in what He's doing in our world and use those resources to bless others. God bless you.